Hi, I'm Sunny Dean.
And I'm Scott Drakeford.
And this is the Publishing Rodeo Podcast. In 2022, we both launched debut novels in the same genre with the same publisher in the same year. But despite having very similar starts, our books and subsequently each of our careers went in very different directions.
That pattern repeats itself throughout the industry over and over. Why do some books succeed while others seem to be dead on arrival?
In this podcast, we aim to answer those questions and many more, along with how to build and maintain an author career.
Everyone signing a contract deserves to know what they're really signing up for. In an industry that loves its secrets, we'll be sharing real details from real people. We'll cover the gamut of life as a Big Five published author, from agents to publishing contracts, finances, and more.
Talk about the absence at the start.
Do we?
at least acknowledge it. Time has passed. And what brings us back to it, which is, I think, we stopped when we ran out of things to say and had books to work on, and we wanted to record one again because we fucking felt like it, and we don't need to do this for sponsorships. We have no rules and we have no bosses. We have no schedule we need to follow. No baby Jesus dolls that we need to sell, if you remember that. Jesus dolls.
They never gave us that sweet sponsorship, huh?
We talked about having a guest for this one, and I think actually it just takes a lot of stress out to not do that. As much as I have enjoyed all of our guests, and I don't regret any of the ones that we recorded, including the ones we couldn't air, there were like 4 or 5 episodes, I think, in the end, which never actually made it out due to either like the episode had to be pulled or guests, you know, felt they kind of changed their mind, which is totally within their remit, or they just didn't have the time to get around to edits and approval. And that's fine, but man, it adds a lot of stress and time, basically, and a lot of edits, and maybe we'll bring one on again sometime, but I'm not fussed at the moment.
That, and nobody really wants to talk about how shitty it is after a first contract is gone and what the state of the industry really looks like. So I guess it's just us, huh?
I think that's the heart of the issue. So there has been a lot of chatter this year. You know, I guess everyone's on the same zeitgeist wave about career longevity and life after debut. And that's something that obviously we have been dealing with ourselves, and we've been talking about a lot with our friends. The kind of the heart of what's even driving this brief revival from the grave, to which we shall shortly climb back in, is the fact that we probably know fewer people now who are agented or in contract than we did when this podcast started. And that's not because our friendship group has changed. That's because a lot of people are just not, or even like if there are some people are there, but they're like career ghosts, I want to say. Mm-hmm. I remember reading that statistic about how a lot of books fall off. A lot of authors get kind of bumped out of the industry after the first couple of books, their contract wraps up, and thinking, that's so high, surely it won't be that bad. And, you know, a few years down the line, I'm looking at it going, actually, that's about right, I think. Probably at least 40% of the people we know are struggling to to stay in or are totally gone. And that includes some very big books where, you know, the first book didn't actually do very well. And so the second book is kind of there, but has like no reads or anything.
I mean, my second book has like 37 Goodreads ratings or something a year after release. Like basically just friends and family, and not even most of those have read it. But that's somewhat expected given the circumstance, right? But yeah, for that to happen to big books, or at least a big debut, and then their second book lands like that, I mean, you're just never safe.
The thing that we keep coming up against again and again is we have friends that like their book does not even badly, and not even like middling. Sometimes the book does really quite well, like hitting Sunday Times list. I know that that doesn't mean what it used to, because nowadays the, you know, crateflation and listflation is such that hitting the list is like a minimum rather than, you know, a great celebration for publishers. They just see it as whatever. But, you know, books that earn out and they do really well and they hit lists and they make award lists, and the publishers then turn around and go, still not good enough. We think your second book is not going to sell. Right. And that's That's just crazy to me because there is a drop from debut to sophomore and publishers seem to know it is. And when I talked about it a bit on Threads, the wonderful Chuck Tingle commented and he said that he'd been told by publishers that, yeah, your second book generally sells about 30% less. And publishers just seem to know this and they just seem to take it for granted. And instead of like kind of supporting the book 30% more, I guess, I don't know. They just seem to kind of bake that into their future predictions and go, oh, well, based on this, we think your next book is going to do like that. And they don't calculate your sale. They don't calculate your crates. They assume that's not going to happen. They assume that all the good things that lined up for the first book won't repeat. So they end up with this very low prediction for what your second book is. And based off that, they then don't offer contracts. Or my new least favorite thing, which is offering people, telling people, oh, if you pitch your option now, we won't buy your book.
Yeah.
So why don't you wait till the sales come through for your second one and try again? And like a lot of people are hearing that, I think, from different publishers. And to me, I personally can't see the advantage for authors. I feel like if you wait for those sales to come back, they're not going to be good because book two is not going to get pushed. And you're then going to have to, you're going to get rejected anyway, but you're going to have to go and sub with a bad sales record as opposed to an unknown one.
Well, and I mean, the drop in sales makes sense from book one to book two for a series, right? For, I mean, typically we're selling trilogies because there's just naturally going to be a drop off of people who read the first book and didn't like it enough to continue. And nobody, or at least nobody sane, is reading a book two without having read book one. But for, you know, a contract like yours, where you have a contract for three standalones, that just, I mean, minus those big things you mentioned, like crates, Barnes and Noble picks, et cetera, that are much harder to account for. That makes sense. Stripping those out of, or at least applying some modifier to represent not being able to count on those happening again for sales projections makes sense, right? But absent those, there's absolutely no reason for a publisher to just assume that a second book not in a series is going to sell worse, especially given the name recognition that the first book will have built in the fandom. The only reason would be lack of publisher output, right? Lack of publisher effort.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, they dictate how our careers start. They dictate how our careers progress. And then they get to set the terms for when and how we sign a second deal. The unfortunate thing is that it's not cut and dry either. Like, I can think of at least a dozen or more authors who signed either low or middling deals for debut contracts, right? And they finished out that contract. They didn't get a second contract based on the option that they turned in. But they didn't just like stop writing, and that's why they haven't been picked up again. They're still writing. They, in their minds, are still a published author. And I mean, they are, right?
Yeah.
But a lot of people are pushed out of the industry and are just spinning their wheels on this dream and hoping to get back in, when I just don't see that happening, other than a few instances where people are switching genres or changing names, etc. And even then, that seems very, very rare.
We actually we collected some responses to talk to people about this, which, you know, came with the caveat that they were happy, not the caveat, which came with the condition they were happy for some of them to be shared. And it was just it was about different people's experiences, because not everyone necessarily wanted to talk about it, but some did. And, you know, some people, so some of the questions that we asked were basically, you know, what year did you debut? Because I think that makes the difference. I think people, I find generally people who debuted a bit earlier seem more optimistic. Possibly that's self-selecting because they debuted earlier and they're still here. They've survived. but let's see.
I don't think I've seen this. I don't think I've seen the responses. Ooh. So I'm very interested.
Oh, okay. Can you actually see this? So, well, okay. We can edit through it as needed, but basically it was like, were you a lead? You know, how were you published? Most people responding were big five. And it's a mix of things. You know, what was your experience like working on book two? You know, so one person said they felt the biggest difference was a systemic thing that went beyond publishing. Even though book two is a better book, there wasn't debut buzz. So I think that is a real thing, that is legitimately an issue. You're not new and exciting anymore once you've published your first book. And this is something I'm thinking about a lot because I feel like I had a really good start. My book did probably as well as I could have hoped for it to do. And I'm staring down the barrel of book two, and I'm very acutely aware that all the things which lined up for Book Eaters are not going to line up the same way again for Girl with a Thousand Faces. Just all the different special editions that we got, you know, all the different book of the month, you know, that's out of your control. The things that made the biggest difference to my sales, I don't think I will necessarily get. And that means I'm relying on track record, which I'm not convinced sells books, and the publisher putting in the effort a second time, which you need with the standalone.
Yeah, that is interesting because, I haven't read the final draft yet, but I've said it before, but as much as I love Book Eaters, I do think Girl with a Thousand Faces is better. And
I think it's only better, but it's not a high concept book. I think the cover helped to make it high concept in a way. It really needed that. And I'm tracking all kinds of metrics, right? So for the first time around, I tracked Goodreads ads for Book Eaters month by month. Again, and I'm doing the same. I'm way behind compared to Book Eaters at the moment. Mm. I tracked cover reveal, but I think, we did this, didn't we? We talked a bit about the cover reveal and went back through like all of Tor's cover reveals the past 2 years and like put it in like a data sheet. Yep. And I think honestly, the overwhelming trend was that the response you get to a cover reveal is actually reflective of how big your platform is already rather than indicative of organic excitement around the book. You know, obviously Brandon Sanderson gets like his cover reveal is just like, they don't even do them sometimes. They're just like, there's a new Brandon Sanderson book coming out with like the kind of blank template and that'll get like 15,000 likes. Cause you know, you could do like clip art of just some stick figures and it wouldn't matter. His readership will buy it because they love his books and they love him. So he almost doesn't need that. But anyway, I got totally sidetracked there. Yeah. So
I hope it goes well. I feel like you've got a lot of fans out there, especially amongst booksellers. And I hope that translates to at least the book getting a shot to be on shelves.
So some people felt like most things were the same. Some people felt like there was a steep drop off in support, interest, quality, you know, no print arcs for second books. That's quite common.
Really?
Tor were like, of course there will be arcs. Why wouldn't there be? But I did have to push a little bit on the UK side. I don't think they saw the advantage, except that they did want to match the energy level kind of thing from the States. It's one of those things where when publishers say, well, we're not sure arcs help, and you think, well, then why the fuck do you print so many of them for like lead titles? And I believe they help. I mean,
yes.
I think basically like what I get from all these responses is that it is hard to sustain internal momentum with your team.
Yeah.
And I think that is one of the big drivers. This is great article from the bookseller where they were talking about all these articles that have been coming out about career drop off. And it has this quote from David Headley where he's like, well, the biggest impact on sales is staff turnover, as people leave and no one cares about the book.
Yeah.
And where's it gone? David Headley. Yeah. Sales track is an issue, and it is rarely the author's fault if ever, says DHH Literary MD David Headley. He points out the high staff turnover in publishing houses as one of the major issues driving poor sales. An editor buys the book, then the editor leaves. An assistant takes over. There is no marketing spend. There is no real passion because it was not bought by that editor. So how does that affect the author's career? Headley says this happened to one of his authors recently. The book sold 275 copies. It was a lead title, but the editor left and the book was orphaned. And that is the reality of the situation. Publishers need to get control of what they're doing. It's a kind of brutal statement, but he's not wrong.
A lead title sold 275 copies?
If there's no internal hype, there's no hype at all. You know, I think you've got to be passionate about your book, and then your agent and your editorial team and the sales team, and then all that feeds all the way down. I think more and more that is like such an important component, and you have to find ways to drive that hype. Either you're so fucking big that everyone's terrified. Yes. You know, no one's going to let Brandon Sanderson's books down, are they? Sorry to keep using an example, Mr. Sanderson. But no one's going to let...
I mean, even
like J.K. Rowling, right? Like, I bet you her staff fucking hate her, but they're not going to do anything to not push those books.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to say a tier down because that's rude, but a tier or two down, right? And I'm not going to name names after I say something like that, but it does seem like your only choice is to get big enough that you have your pick of publishers, and therefore your publisher knows that they're going to lose a moneymaker if they don't put out or run the gauntlet, right? You're in a lottery where everything has to line up correctly. And it seems like the number of people who make it out of that gauntlet to that one of those tiers, doesn't have to be that Sanderson tier, but one of those tiers where you effectively have your pick of publishers and therefore get the treatment that you should as a business partner, is very small, right? Like I don't know anybody personally who has made that leap from okay sales or even a debut lead title up into that they can go anywhere they want.
I know one or two. So pretty much everyone we know, I think their contracts, they've either been offered the same money more or less yes. on the second yes. contract. And the, Gareth Brown is one person who's bucked that trend. I think he was like a kind of 500K range advance the first contract. His next book is higher, but obviously the first book did sell like really, really well. It was a 2-book contract, right? So his second book is kind of out now. Another one, Nick Bench, if you remember, he had all this stuff with film deals going on. He was offered yep. more. Yeah, I'll get back to you on that if I can think of anyone else. I mean, they do exist. They do. But generally, it is the people who are getting more the second time around were like lead titles the first time or lead debuts. Richard Swan got a bit more, didn't he?
It was like a little bit more though. Like if you account for inflation, it might be less. and that, I mean, that's probably one of the examples that surprised me the most. Because his debut trilogy sold extremely well.
Yeah.
He is very, as far as I can tell, he's very easy to work with from the publisher side because he hands in very clean drafts. He's very productive. He's a very good writer, in my opinion. And still, despite sales, despite all of those other intangibles, or I guess perhaps tangibles in some cases, didn't really result in a huge outcome. And hopefully he still has a huge outcome coming in the future, but...
Well, he's diversifying, isn't he? So, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, so I think like Andrea Stewart was also on here. She's very transparent about her finances. I think she had essentially the same deal again. Most people I know either did not get an option or did not get an increase if someone offered on their option. I think for Tor, the people a year before me and our year, I think I'm kind of the only one of like the actual debuts, like that was in quotation marks, not not people who have had a self-pub history, which I'll get to in a second, who's maybe still standing. I'm not including like Nightfire and Tor.com. I think Ronnie's still in limbo. I've not heard from him recently. Obviously your situation is kind of, you can talk about that or not if you want. I think other than that, yeah, people like Nisha Tooley and Chuck Tingle, they're doing really well, but they had a self-pub platform that they brought with them.
Yeah.
And basically just, I'm always going to sound like I'm wailing on Reddit, but because I think Reddit reflects a lot of author opinion and that, you know, I remember there being a lot of discussion on Reddit about the things that we say and how there's a general sense that, oh, you know, if you keep your head down, keep working, you can work your way up the advanced ladder. And my difficulty with that is it just feels like bullshit because I don't feel like that's happening for most people we know. Maybe we just have shit friends. I don't know. Unlucky friends.
I don't think that's the case, because I mean we've kind of tried to keep tabs on general outcomes, right? Of people who
You care
debuted
what happens
or
to friends, yeah.
Well, I mean, even beyond friends. So like James Rollins, right? He debuted, quote unquote, with his fantasy around when my debut came out, my first book came out. And obviously he came from writing thrillers where he's a New York Times bestseller. And I think his books did okay, but I don't think they hit it out of the park. And I don't know, I don't think I've seen an announcement at least for a follow-up after that original trilogy that he signed for. Like, that's a big name, an established writer who, as far as I can tell, might be on the way out of sci-fi and fantasy. I don't know. I should probably look him up and
No, yeah, I mean, this is
maybe
the
edit his name
thing.
out.
This is the thing that kind of fills me with a quiet terror is there's a very real sense that what publishers are looking for is a bestseller, not just a great bestseller that hits list and drops like a stone, but a bestseller with good sell-through, hardback and paperback. And all that buys you is the next day of execution, to borrow Richard's amazing phrase. And for me, it feels a little bit like being the miller's daughter in Rumpelstiltskin, right? Where someone has told the king that you can spin gold, and you manage to spin gold one time, and so he comes back is like, "Here's more straw, make more gold." And obviously, the difference there is I'm choosing to be here, and the miller's daughter isn't, and I choose to be here because. Because if you can spin enough gold, one day you get to be the pretty little publishing princess and you can live safe for the rest of your life in the castle and not have to spend anything. Or rather, it doesn't matter what you spin or don't. But of course, the other difference is there's no Rumpelstiltskin to come and do it for me. So I have to actually spin this shit myself. But yeah, I feel more secure than most of our friends. I'm in a better position than a lot of people I know. I'm very privileged in that way. And I still worry about it. It still keeps me up at night because I look at that next book and think everyone is assuming it's going to do 30% worse than the first one. And I think it could do, if it doesn't get picked book of the month, then it's the paperback will sell far worse than 30%. I think, it's not gotten all the different special. Yeah, there's it's you stress about it and you don't want to be that person who a year from now, some other podcast is like, "Oh yeah," and then Sunny Dean fucking disappears. Oh my fucking God.
Yeah, I mean, it does. Yeah. And I don't recall exactly who was mentioned in this article, but there was an article shared in our Discord about how, I
Was
mean,
Toni Morrison.
yeah, okay, it was Toni Morrison, that's right. Authors had a chance to work up to building themselves a career and developing a style and whatever else, whereas now that's just not the case. You don't get 3 or 6 or 10 books over 10 to 15 years to just keep taking shots. You get your first book basically, and if that book doesn't break out, you're fucked.
It feels like that at the moment. I subscribed to the bookseller and I was following the Frankfurt Book Fair, which we talked about before this started, but because my agent is taking Girls 1,000 Phases as to Frankfurt as like a hot list book. And I was just in, I didn't go to Frankfurt with book eaters because American agencies, unless they're massive, don't tend to go as much, I think. But yeah, one of the articles there, this guy was saying in Frankfurt this year, there are two genres. Romanticy and non-romanticy. And you read stuff like that and you think, oh, fucking hell, like only one genre seems to matter at a time. Everything has to be a breakout or it's dropped. And once it is a breakout, you have to keep being a breakout. And
You and I chatted this week about, hey, we should put together a little ebook or pamphlet or whatever with all the things we've learned or think we've learned from doing these interviews. And I think one of the big ones really is editor influence, but especially as a debut, how in the hell are you supposed to know what the internal politics of a publisher's editor group looks like. The best you can do really is take shots at editors who have produced very big sellers in the past. But then, I mean, this is what I'm sweating about right now with my historical fiction about the founding of Mormonism is on sub right now. And it's on sub with a whole bunch of big time editors, which is awesome, but it's also very difficult because they undoubtedly have very large submission piles that I have to stand out in. And they have very high standards of what books they're going to take. And even then, you still just don't know where it's going to land. Even if one of them were to take it, you don't know where it's going to land on their priority list, which then determines where it lands on the publisher's priority list. So it's a very opaque industry. Feels hard to make informed choices that improve your ability. And it feels like writing an awesome book isn't enough. And especially writing an awesome book isn't enough if it doesn't happen to be your debut somehow and fall right in line with what people are looking to acquire.
I think this response captures something really well for me. 6 books in, I'm more worried than I've felt since I debuted. I feel like I was steadily building momentum, but am now being harmed by the sales track record that comes with starting with smaller publishers. I'm moderately confident I'll secure some form of publishing deal, but not remotely confident it will be equal or larger, or at the equal or larger publishers than my current one, which makes the continued workload and health/family cost of publishing side of writing harder and harder to justify. There are some positive responses in here, but I guess I look at the ones that reflect how I'm feeling and the things that I worry about. I'm glad that some people have survived and are feeling a little bit better, but not everyone does.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. You know, one thing I've been thinking about is I'm actually quite glad that I published under not my real name for my debut. And I mean, there's no harm in publishing under your real name and then going to a pseudonym, but it does leave, you know, more options open for me for future pseudonyms to try.
We'll be hearing from Drake Scottford very soon.
Drake Scottford. Maybe. And you know, I am never going to give up on the Scott Drakeford stuff either. So that name will die hard. But I mean, it's a real thing to consider, you know, like all these people submitting to publishers and then overjoyed that they get a deal, any deal. If you take anything from our podcast, just buckle the fuck up and make contingency plans, because the best way to make it in this industry is to make it from day one.
I think it's interesting that there is a spate of people talking about these situations, and that there is a real sense of anxiety that's worth looking at and not just ignoring. I think there is something there beyond just social media hysteria. A lot of people are feeling very insecure. The turnover is insane. I've not kept track of the US side so much, but like Harper had a crazy 2 years here. Simon & Schuster in the UK has also had a crazy couple of years. And what was the other one? Hotter in the UK. Oh my God.
You mean editor turnover and staff?
And editor and staff turnover, which then feeds all the way down the line to authors. Orbit as well, I think, on the US side are having an interesting time. It's everywhere, basically. It's sort of every imprint, at least in our genre. And I don't know what I want from this discussion other than I deal with anxiety by like drawing everyone into my circle of anxious until they feel anxious too, which is essentially what this podcast is for. And I guess if there's merit in telling people that, you know, you're not alone or whatever, or maybe we're just talking to the wind, Where's that guy gone? 10k sales threshold. I wonder if we have time to seg into that. Unless you've got anything else to add into this wall of gloom. But mostly I just wanted to highlight a range of experiences and be like, look, this is how it looks from where I'm stood. Maybe if you're on a different patch of ground, it's better. It's more hopeful. Maybe everything comes in waves and it just happens to be that because, you know, the same way a lot of my friends debuted within a narrow bracket of years, a lot of us are facing tricky times at the same time. Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I personally just think it's helpful for people to know what they're aiming for, right? And to know what that means for them going forward. I mean, there are publishers popping up now, and I think more in the UK, and, you know, the ones that come to mind are the ones that are associated with the subscription boxes. So Daphne with IC, and then The Broken Binding with their subscriptions that I think fund a lot of excellent risk taking. But I think there are new models emerging where people who really care about books are building publishing companies that can do pretty cool things, right? And so we've mentioned it on the podcast before, but I offered my rights in the UK free of advance for a reason, and that's because I believed very deeply in these people that I offered it to, and there should be an announcement forthcoming. And because I'm essentially trying to get another shot at relaunching, getting in, you know, maybe some editing that lines up with the story that I am actually trying to tell, getting the book in people's hands that are hopefully closer to the target market, that kind of thing. So, I mean, we're not trying to preach a hard and fast rule of either you're a super lead or you have no chance and there's nothing else you can do, and that's the only kind of deal you should take. However, I mean, what we're seeing is pretty stark.
However, we're seeing that the people I know personally who are doing okay or better than okay are disproportionately people who had a big advance out the gate.
Yep.
And by okay, I don't mean like, because there's this thing where people go, oh, but you know, you can, you know, if you're still making a few grand, thousand grand from your books every year, that's okay. That's not what I mean. I just mean like they're in the industry at all. It's the issues is just, there's not, it's like there's, you're not in the industry or you're doing really well, and there's very, very few people who are clinging on to that middle kind of.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually, is that, you know, a lot of people bring up, oh, well, I don't mind if I just sign deal after deal where my book only gets me a $10,000 advance or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And the thing is, I don't see anybody doing that. I, other than very established authors, I don't see any recent debuts that do anything other than get to that level of repeat six-figure offers, or they're just out.
So I see it at the indie press level. And this is where I'm quite sad, because we did one interview with Broken Binding and one with George Sanderson, who runs Titan, and we weren't able to air both of them in the end for various reasons that are not the faults of those people. But, you know, one of the things that Matt talked about Broken Binding is he thought that there would be an increase in smaller publishers. And one of the things that I loved about Titan, why we talked to George, is because I do know authors there who routinely get the same advance, who routinely get kind of steady advance levels, and they're not making like mega bucks, but they are kind of like improving and building and growing in that way that authors kind of used to at the bigger publishers, where I think it's getting harder to stay at the top.
Can you think of a similar example in the US? Are there any publishers doing that in the US that you know of?
I don't know the US as well. I'm sure there are some. I mean, Orbit itself has a functioning midlist still, although I hear that's changing a little bit, but I can't comment on that. No direct experience.
I can't think of anybody who debuted with a smaller deal with them and got another similar deal. It's all been six figures and up that have
are still kept around. Going. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even then, there's some six figure deals that have disappeared. They're just into a black hole. Haven't heard from those authors in like a couple of years.
Yep. Yeah. And I,
places like Red Tower, maybe?
Maybe, but I mean, they're the ones that did
Fourth Wing, yeah, but Wing, that's an though, outlier. Right, so. A lot of their books are smaller.
Yeah.
I mean, you get it in other genres, definitely like romance and contemporary and, you know, Harlequin, Scholastic, places like that, which are not big five, but are big.
Sure.
They have midlists of various types.
Anyway, sorry, didn't mean to interrupt and derail.
No, you're not at all. I do think, I will say some positives. So I think for me this time around, some things that are a lot easier is I am a lot better positioned to help my publisher in a way that I was not for book one. And I know we talked about your internal team having hype or not, and I would actually add a third category, which is they're excited, but they don't have the time and resources. You can do things for them. Sometimes that can really help, right? And so like this time, you know, I didn't know anyone when I first got published. This time I was like, I have a spreadsheet and it's got like 50 names in it. And these are people you can ask for blurbs or send arcs to or reach out for. And they're all like categorized by country with contact details, how I know them or don't know them or why I think they're suitable. My publicists love that on both sides. They're like, oh, cool. This is great.
Yeah.
And we're all kind of working out the doc. And that way we don't have to like waste time emailing each other. You can be like, okay, they've emailed that person, I've emailed this person, you know, we divvied up the labor, you can see responses as they come in. When I get a blurb that's come in, you know, they check it every so often and they kind of stick it on like the editorial section on Amazon or whatever, things like that. I feel like because I know more what's going on, I can anticipate things better.
Yeah.
I can call on favors. I have my own links with bookshops now. Stuff like that does make it easier. And things that I wouldn't do as a debut, like I wouldn't go and set up an event. I am this time. I'm setting up, you know, my own launch and my own after party and actually having people who will attend. There are things you can do for yourself when you're not a debut that you cannot do as a debut. When you are a debut, you do need your publisher to like haul ass. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, the fact that they not as much ass as being hauled, that sounded terrible for sophomore books, because the debut buzz is just gone. You can kind of mediate it a bit, maybe. I don't know. Yeah. Not if you're in a series, though. If you're in a series, you're a bit fucked. Sorry.
Yeah, you are. 100%. Yeah.
That should have put that caveat first, because the problem is your series is really just a long continuation of book one.
It is.
Whereas this feels like we're rebooting me, because it's been four goddamn years since I've, or will be. Oh, fucking hell.
But, I mean, I keep saying this as well, but that initial deal of three standalones is so smart. Yeah. So smart.
Yeah, totally my idea. No, it wasn't, but it's a boon. I'm very glad I haven't been writing Devon Book 2 this whole time. This may be a good point to second to an article that we've talked about some, which is why publishing is becoming like this a little bit. And I think there's lots of different reasons, but there's this great article from, what's his name, Todd Satterston. We talked about having him on as a guest and we were too lazy to organize it and decided we'd just talk about his article without him here. And it's called The Magic Number. And I found it really, really fascinating and actually really quite hopeful, because basically he's saying that there is a kind of magic sales threshold, similar to when Dr. Carey Prey was saying there's like a magic marketing threshold that you have to hit for books to actually succeed. And he's saying there is a magic sales threshold that books have to hit within a certain time frame to have a chance of success. Mm-hmm. And he was looking at nonfiction, but I found that I think it's broadly true for fiction as well. Yeah, I mean, I'll link to it in like our notes and stuff, but Let's scroll down. So he used a data set of 6,775 titles. Again, business and self-help, published between 2012 and 2015. So it's quite old now. So there's this magic number that apparently comes up in publishing of 10,000 copies. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that if you can get 10,000 copies into the marketplace, it reaches that point, which Richard Swan has talked about with, he quoted his editor, James Long, the point where a book has a chance to grow its own legs and is not just relying on marketing push. And so one of the things he goes into is the fact that, you know, when a book has a big burst of sales at the start, but that's 95% of all the copies it's ever going to sell, that yeah. indicates that the publisher was marketing well, but the book has not, for whatever reason, found its longevity, found its audience. It's not self-sustaining. It didn't get into that book orbit that they want, where it's just circling. And that long tail is a much better prediction. Long tail across 6 months or a year is a much better prediction of how a book is doing than that initial list hit.
Yes.
So he found if a book doesn't sell 10,000 copies in its first year, there's only an 11% chance that title will ever sell more than 10,000 copies. Only a 2% chance sales will exceed 25,000, and it gets worse from there.
Yeah.
And this is like a lot of data, I realize. You're like listening in a car and trying to pay attention to traffic. But if you can get in the 10 to 25K copy range for the first yeah. year, you've got a 42% chance of selling more than 25,000 copies. And essentially what he's saying is the higher you can get into any bracket in the first year, the more that predicts your long-term sales, yep. which kind of makes sense, right? Like we know that like when Richard Osman releases a book and he sells 140,000 copies in his first week, we know that that means he's going to sell more. It's not like the next week he drops to zero. But what he's saying is that there is a floor for this, which is you can't hit that 10K sales threshold in a year. The book is probably going to struggle long term.
Yeah.
And not explode and not pick up. But I found that hopeful because firstly, to just have the number, firstly, long tail matters. So, you know, continuing to promote a book after it's out.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to all get that in the first week. It's not all about that. And secondly, yep. it basically suggests that quality does make a difference. Mm-hmm. It might not in terms of like the advance you get, you might not get a flashy advance, but if there's enough support to get the book to a basic threshold, if it has staying power, it will stay.
That said, it has to get to at least 10,000, yeah. if not 25,000 in that first yeah. year, which I mean, that's attainable. That's a very attainable number in trad publishing. But as far as I know, it's mostly books that are debuting with six-figure
yes.
advances that are getting to those numbers.
So, I mean, he went into more specifics. So he said a book that sells consistently, for example, 300 copies a week for 50 weeks has statistically is better positioned for long-term success versus yeah. a book that sells most of its 15,000 copies in the opening 10 weeks. So he's not even talking about crates, but it really applies to crates.
Yes.
That if most of your copies sell because you were in a crate and there's nothing else going on. And that's relevant to publishers because I think there is like a little bit of laziness going on in the UK. This kind of sense that like, oh, the book got in the crates. So we don't have to do jack shit now. We just yeah. collect those sales, treat the book as finished, a finished product where we made a fixed number of sales that we can bank on, which we then don't factor into your success when offering you a new contract because we can't count on you getting that again, which is wild, right? It's like, oh, we made all this money from your crate sales, but we're going to assume that it won't happen. You won't, lightning won't strike twice. So We're going to say, actually, if you discount crate sales, your sales sucked, even though that's the publisher's responsibility and all oh, fucking yeah. hell.
Well, and I don't think it's any secret yeah. that even on the US side, that publishers will put a lot of effort into the lead up to a debut. And maybe in the few weeks, or if you're lucky, a few months after debut. But yeah. very rarely am I seeing at least significant effort put in those months, you know, 3 to 12 that this study suggests are actually the critical months yeah. for sustaining sales.
And he's not the only person to say that. I've heard from the publicity lady that showed up in that Reddit, where mm-hmm. she was saying it's ridiculous that actually, well, I assume it's a she, it could be a he. They said they assume that they think it's ridiculous that like the push stops, you know, 3 months after after the book comes out, because actually there is momentum to be had.
Yeah.
And if the goal is to sell 10K copies consistently, steadily in the first year, that's the biggest help you can give books.
If we have the link, if we have the link to that AMA, we should definitely put it in, because that was so good.
Yeah, so back up for people listening, there was a kind of big five publicity person who came and did an AMA on Reddit. On marketing, sorry.
Yeah.
And they had a lot of good answers. One of which is like, how do you drum up internal hype for your book? And the answer is you don't. You have an agent who puts the fear of fucking God into your editorial team so that they are terrified every time an email arrives from them. And I thought that's hilarious.
They were very in favor of mean agents.
And doesn't that run contrary to the be nice
stuff? For sure.
Or maybe you can be nice, but your agent better be a dick.
Yeah. And better stay on top of stuff. And I mean, I wish I had that pulled up and had read through it right before I should have been prepared with that. But the things that stick out to me were her giving very clear answers to things like, what kind of time are you giving to the lead titles in any given season versus everything else? And so she was saying that, you know, there are however many, two or three lead titles in any given season that they're working on, and then potentially what, up to a dozen or more other titles that they are covering for that same season.
Yeah.
And they said straight up that something like 70 to 80% of their time and effort and money and everything is going to those two or three lead titles in that season. And the remaining 20% of their effort / money budget is going to that other bucket of books that, you know, hopefully they can find something to do for them, but often it's likely going to be just putting the ebook on NetGalley.
That was a thing that I did notice when I was going through the 2 years of cover reveals, that actually perhaps what was more relevant was not the likes that an individual post got, but the repetition of likes for books which were expected to be big hitters. So if you're a big hitter, you get like the deal announcement, or the, you know, if it's part of a bigger deal, the announcement that there will be a book. And then you get like the cover reveal. And then you get, you know, a post when they have arcs coming out, and you get like when there's a giveaway, and then, oh, this book is out soon. And oh, book birthday, the book is out now. And oh, don't forget, this book is out now. And and now it's out in paperback, right? But if you're kind of mid-list, it's more like deal announcement for one deal. You don't repeat it for subsequent books. It didn't seem like cover reveal, happy birthday, book is out. And that's kind of it. So I think it's not even sometimes the money. I think she said in one of her comments, it's about like the creativity that they're allowed to devote.
Yeah.
The mind brain power that you're allowed to devote to certain books. You've got to put that emphasis on the bigger ones. And thinking of the re-release, I think this is I know people aren't always keen on hardbacks, but having that hardback paperback release means you do kind of stay in this field of vision for your publisher that little bit longer, because that is a thing. The paperback coming out, it just extends the longevity of your book. Like, you get two launches, so all the best things that happened for my book really on the US side were the paperback, all the different promos and things when it becomes more affordable, book of the month picks and stuff. So so anyway, that was like a very hodgepodge kind of collection of different thoughts, gripes, some bright spots.
If people aren't used to us rambling by now, they never will be.
No, I mean, I kind of organize it when I do it later, but oh, you found it, the Alma thing. Yeah. We will link it, because it was an interesting read. But that's just kind of where we are and what we're doing now, that we're both trying to survive second book to get to the second contract.
Yeah.
In your case, on submission, if you can say that, I think. In my case, I'm tracking everything that I can track about my book to see, not because I can change the outcome, but because documenting it, it doesn't, no, I was going to say it makes you feel better. That's a lie. Because I feel compelled to do so. I feel compelled to document it and see what's different and what's the same. And whether some of the things I think matter didn't matter, which I didn't have a sense of last time around. You know, it might release, it might do better than Book Eaters, but have like terrible Goodreads ratings or something. I don't know.
So. I don't think it will. And for what it's worth, I do think it makes sense in your situation to be putting effort into maximizing mm-hmm. a good first contract, a very good yeah. first book that earned you a lot of goodwill and a lot of fans. That makes a lot of sense. And yeah, in my case, I'm straight up trying to pivot anywhere I can. Relaunches, and I'm on sub with the historical fiction, and the work in progress is one that could be sold as historical fiction or fantasy, probably historical fantasy under a different name, most likely, but maybe the same name if this relaunch in the UK goes extraordinarily well. Different situations call for different decisions, for sure.
I don't know if I have anything to add to that other than this episode's going to need a lot of unscrambling because I think there's a narrative thread, but we were both all over the place.
And if that's too much work, it can just hangout for us. That's fine. Doesn't have to be released necessarily.
I think I enjoy it. I think I no longer really care if like only 5 people listen or 50,000 people listen. I think in some ways all our worst content often ended up being our most popular, worst as in least nuanced. You know, a lot of people fixated on Carrie Price thing, and their takeaway from that is TradPub doesn't care if your book is garbage. As long as they market it, it will sell. And that's not really true.
Yeah.
Because there is a base level of quality involved, and
for sure.
I don't know. I'm very uncomfortable with this kind of inbuilt assumption, this insinuation that successful books are just sort of garbage by default until proven otherwise.
In fact, I want to mention something so I stayed up until 3 a.m. last night reading Kristen Hannah's The Women, and oh my God, she is so good. She is like my she is like my favorite author, at least of the year. Like, I've burned through. I bet I have a bunch of them behind me. Yep. The Nightingale, The Four Winds, The Great Alone. And I think it's very popular, especially in like publishing or publishing, maybe like aspiring publishing or heavy reader groups, right? Or circles. It's very easy to get into the habit of, you know, trying to find things wrong with people who have found more success or whatever. But I mean, the truth is there is a very real bar of quality that matters. And Kristen Hannah, you live like 20 miles from me. I can probably see your house from mine. I am a huge fan. Maybe cut that. That's an extremely creepy thing to say. But
okay.
The Women, very good book. Or keep it, whatever. We say weird stuff all the time. I'll just get a...
But then you reveal your location. I think just say, we can say you're a huge fan.
I'll get a restraining order in the mail. Yeah, it's a good book, though. I don't know if you've read any of her stuff.
I don't even know what she writes. Is she historical?
Yeah, so she writes, and I mean, they're super popular, so I'm not like finding a new fantastic author. Tons of people know about her. But she writes historical, and her thing, at least, so she's written a whole bunch of books, but these ones that she's written in the last, I don't know, 5-7 years have been very, very popular since The Nightingale, I think, was her first like mega hit. And it's about a woman in France in the lead up and then during Nazi occupation in World War II, and you know what those French freedom fighters went through, etc. But she puts these stories into some sort of a historical setup, but it's almost always a young woman who has some sort of major challenge, but is falling in love at the same time And spoiler alert, most of, if not all of the people that she falls in love with die or almost die in some fashion. And so they're not necessarily like happily ever after stories. But yeah, she's just a great writer. I mean, I get sucked into her books every time and I lose a lot of sleep to them.
No, that's really nice to hear. And, you know, I struggled for a long time with that. I want to call it writer arrogance, the kind of turning your nose up at things, something just because it's popular. Because yeah. I did actually grow up reading a lot of like really fucking weird niche books. Like, I mean, this is like, in case anyone's like it has ever read, you know, The Etched City by K.J. Bishop, you know, that's like a kind of cult classic new weird book that's 95% imagery, 5% plot, has head hopping, it's experimental, it's all kinds of stuff, you know, things, books like that.
Yeah.
And then I write, I've been telling people it's like a joke when they ask, oh, I write commercial shite. And I don't think I told you this story. I went to watch as like a audience member, not a guest. I went to watch a panel that had Dave Ragg, if you remember him, and RJ Barker.
Yeah, of course.
And Adrian Tchaikovsky in it. And we went out to dinner afterwards, and Adrian's wife, who's very nice, her name's Annie, and she asked me what kind of books I write. And I said, commercial shite. And instead of laughing, she just looked at me in like this kind of quiet horror with like, why would you say that about yourself? And it was actually this real moment where I was like, oh, fuck, I feel really bad. Like, maybe it's not really that funny to just like call myself shit all the time. I'm going to stop that. So that might be the last time I ever say that. But yeah, I write very commercial and I read very weird, eclectic literary. And that means I produce this writing that is not the kind of thing I normally read. And I did really struggle with that for a long time. And I don't know if you've read it, but Patrick Stewart had a memoir out a couple of years ago. And one of the themes in that is the fact that, you know, he comes from like this kind of literary Shakespearean background, but the thing he ends up being best known for is Star Trek, like fucking yeah. Star Trek. And how he can, there's this moment where he does really come to terms with it and the whole kind of, but it means something to people. And sometimes you don't need a deeper meaning to art other than people enjoy it. And that it's a shared experience and how meaningful that became to him in a way that was like different. And I think I'm kind of in that place now where I can enjoy commercial fiction more, reading it and writing it, and admit that, you know, I did really like Michael Crichton novels as well as K.J. Bishop.
Absolutely.
Not Dan Brown, though. That's a step too far.
I haven't even tried his book. I'm a little bit afraid to.
There's an interesting review of it in The Guardian where you feel like the reviewer hated it, but he was like basically paid to write a glowing review. So it's like, it's the most damning praise filled review you've ever read. I'll send you a link to it later, but yeah, it's a good thing to hear nice things about books anyway.
Yeah.
Right. I probably better let you go. It's nearly 10 p.m. here, and I've got to go watch TV, which is obviously very important. I just spend my time.
Well, it's always lovely getting to hang out and chat with you.
Well, see you at JT's Jeremy's thing.
Oh yeah, when's that? Oh shit, is that that's not November? Today, right? Okay. No.
You've been listening to the Publishing Radio Podcast with Sonia Dean and Scott Drakeford. Tune in next time for more in-depth discussion on everything publishing industry. See you later.